This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The European Commission this week decided against fining Portugal and Spain for incurring government budget deficits. The decision was made in part because of Britain's decision to exit the EU and because, in general, anti-austerity movements across Europe are feared to be destabilizing the continent. Portugal has a budget deficit of 4.4%, and like Greece, Spain, and many other European nations, it has been rocked by political instability for several years now. In fact, there's been a common theme across Europe with social democratic parties failing to anticipate popular sentiment and finding themselves losing to conservatives. My guest is Catarina Príncipe. She is a social movement activist from Portugal and a member of Bloco de Esquerda. And she writes for Jacobin magazine. She is the co-editor of a new anthology called Europe in Revolt. And in that book, she's written an essay called The Deferred Portuguese Revolution. Welcome to the program, Catarina.
Thank you.
Thanks Hi. So much for joining us. I think our audience here in the U.S. doesn't hear nearly enough about what's happening in Portugal. It tends to not get much Western or rather U.S. media coverage. So let's start with the story that you paint, which is that you start out talking in your essay about how what we are seeing in Portugal today can be traced back to the revolution in Portugal, a revolution that happened later than any other Western nation in the 70s and 80s. Can you set that backdrop for us, how that revolution kind of informs what's happening today?
First of all, thank you for having me. Well, I think it is a shot at trying to understand what were the problems for the revolutionary left, the left in general, or the non-reformist left, if you want, and how and why did the Portuguese Revolution got stopped in the way. So after 19 months of a very, very interesting and dynamic revolutionary process that completely altered the relations of forces between labor and capital in the country for those years. And I think two things are very important to understand. The first is that a lot of the So after 50 years of dictatorship, of a fascist dictatorship, the left was worked in clandestinity. So people had no experience on like daily life policies and how to build majorities, how to work with people, and how to actually find answers for the question of how do we go on from building reforms that change people's lives today to a more long-term perspective, and how do we change society? So people weren't used to dealing with like daily life policy-making politics. And the second reason is because of the history of the country, because of, as I said, 50 years of dictatorship, the left was tiny, unorganized, did not have any like large national party or organization, with the exception of the Portuguese Communist Party that plays a very contradictory role in the Portuguese Revolution, so I don't want to go into that detail. And I think these two factors, so the one that the left did not know exactly how to deal with the demand for small type of reforms, how to deal with the state or state power, and the second reason, the second characteristic that the left was tiny and small and unorganized, kind of like were two very important lessons for the Portuguese left throughout the 80s and the 90s, when the left basically was not present in Portuguese society anymore, to understand that first we need a bigger organization that joins a lot of different people with different political and ideological traditions, and that organization can build a power and can build strength and become a massive party by fighting for short and midterm reforms today, because those were the two things that lacked. And so that was the reason why the left bloc, Bloco de Esquerda, was formed. And this is the party that I'm a member of for many years. And so I think those two lessons totally informed the strategy of the radical left today in Portugal.
And so do you think that the left was, sort of had its main problem be a result of this need for ideological purity, that they failed to see that ordinary needs among the population really needed to be met, needed to be addressed?
I think it's yes and no. I think in a moment of revolution, of a revolutionary process where everything is at question and at stake, the idea of ideological purity, in the sense of like people who have a very clear idea of what you need to actually be able to transform society deeply, is very welcoming and important. But at the same time, a lot of these groups and experiences were very young, composed by young people who had never been able to work publicly on political issues because they weren't allowed in this society, in a fascist society. So there was the lack of practical building of politics, like of disputing daily life questions, and how do we connect the idea of building for example, fighting for a functioning welfare state, which means a particular relation to the state, and at the same time linking it to the idea that we might need a society, or we might want a society, for example, where the state doesn't exist as such. So those two things seem sometimes contradictory. They aren't, or they don't have to be, but that link, how do we make that link in practice, in the practice of political organization, that was basically what lacked to very young, very militant, but very untrained, in a way, people that were important figures during the Portuguese Revolution of 74-75.
And so you mentioned the contradictory role of the Communist Party. What about the Socialist Party? Tell us about the role that the Socialist Party played and continues to play today.
So the Socialist Party was formed during the revolutionary process as a party that actually intended to give a voice and an answer and a platform for the people who were discontent by the turmoil that any revolutionary process creates, which can be an amazing experience also, right? And so they were basically the party of a center-left party, the party that was able to capture the feeling of uncertainty and difficulty and you know, when people are living in a moment that they don't know what's going to happen. It's normal that people want answers and want stability and are afraid of what might happen. And so the Socialist Party was that platform. And from the beginning on, the Socialist Party was traditionally as a party belonging to the group of the Socialist International, so the traditional European social democracies like the Labour Party in England or the SPD in Germany. So they were parties that, or the Socialist Party was a party that, yes, wanted to provide a lot of the social measures that were absolutely needed in one of the poorest countries in Europe at the time, that was Portugal, like a functioning welfare state, having hospitals and schools and railroads and reboosting work and somehow reorganizing the productive and the economy, which of course was needed, and the modernization of the country. But at the same time, was very clear that what they always wanted was to make Portugal an active belonging part of Western capitalism. So it was the idea to open the Portuguese market to Western capital. So that's always the role that the Socialist Party has been playing. On the one hand, it does have, and it's still the role today, it does have a foundational principle idea of some sort of functioning welfare state, less and less so actually, but if we take in consideration the last 30 to 40 years of Portuguese history, we see that some of the harshest measures, I want to exclude the last 4 years when Portugal was under the memorandum of the Troika, but excluding those last 4 years, if we look at the history, the Socialist Party has actually been the party that has applied some of the harshest measures on like cutting of labor rights, the liberalization of the labor market, and also the attacks on a social functioning welfare state.
And so, in fact, on that question, Katharina, is that why you see right-wing governments, not just in Portugal, but because of similar reactions from these social democratic parties, right-wing governments elsewhere in Europe also rising? Because in many ways, the broad left, not the radical left, but the social democratic parties have failed people.
Yes. Exactly. I think that is precisely the question. Like, it's very hard to distinguish today the political and economic program of the, I used to say, this is the expression that I normally use, the traditional, now liberalized social democracy, so social liberal parties. It's very hard to see the difference between their programs and the programs of the right, the center right, or even the right. There are maybe some differences, but not in all countries. Like, for example, same-sex couple marriages, for example, that might be a difference between some of the socialist parties and some of the right-wing parties. But in general, the differences are not many. And so basically that is the reason, and yes, I agree with you, that is the reason why people feel that they have failed them and don't see what is the difference between what they are doing and what the right-wing parties are doing.
Right.
So
let's talk about the anti-austerity protests in Portugal and what the grassroots reaction has really been like. Where has it primarily come from? In countries like Greece and Spain, we saw a lot of the anti-austerity energy flow into parties like Syriza and Podemos. Has that happened similarly in Portugal with the left bloc?
Unfortunately, not. And not directly. I mean, it's difficult to say because at the time, so we have not experienced the same type or the same form of organized protest as Spain or Greece did. So we had moments, very strong, very important moments of social mobilizations in the last years against austerity that for sure changed the relation that people had with austerity and the relation that people had with the right-wing government that was in power at the time. But they weren't daily organized forms of political experience and activity. So there were moments of very big, huge demonstrations on the streets, like the biggest demonstrations that Portugal has ever witnessed. But at the same time, there wasn't a continuated activity at the time that provided people a platform, a space to continuously engage and organize against austerity. So the first of these protests happened in the 12th of March, 2011. That was even before we had a memorandum with the Troika. And it was very centered on a very important question in Portugal that has been somehow a motor of the reorganization of the labor of the social movement in Portugal, which has to do with the question of precarity, so of precarious working conditions. And so we had this in March, and the elections that followed gave an absolute majority to the right wing. So it was clear at the time that the left was not able to capitalize on this discontent and actually transform the anger and the grievances into a political answer to the left. In the last 4 years during the memorandum years in Portugal, we've seen these protests growing even more and more. But before the elections in October that elected this new socialist-led government or socialist party-led government, there was almost nothing because people could not see and could not understand this was actually happening all over, a direct link between protest and grievances and actually policy changing. And the left was, again, not really able to like transform this anger into organization. Although, and this is why I'm saying, on the one hand, this link is not direct, but on the other hand, the left did win a lot of votes in October. So Bloco had 10% and the Communist Party had 8%, which amounts to a total of more, actually a bit more than 18% of radical left MPs on Portuguese parliament. So that's a lot. So the right wing was able to win again, but they lost a lot of votes. So they didn't get an absolute majority. And therefore, looking at the parliamentary situation, what happened was that the Socialist Party, so the Social Liberal Party, plus the two parties on the left had absolute majority on parliament. And so that's why this scenario, this type of minority government with a parliamentary support of two left-wing parties is happening right now, because it was possible. But you were asking me, sorry.
How is it then that the right has managed to even stay in power to the extent that it has managed to have enough support on the ground? I mean, we seem to see a political polarization in many countries.
I think I would say three reasons. First, this is a very important thing. Just some months before the elections of October 2015, the Troika, so Portugal was under a bailout, the first bailout, like Greece. Greece is already under the third or fourth now. So Portugal was under a bailout. And the European Central Bank created a special program to deal with the Portuguese public debt called the Public Sector Purchase Program, which basically bought directly from the Portuguese state. So the European Central Bank bought that by directly Portuguese debt in order to lower the interest rates so that Portuguese could fulfill the last evaluation of the Troika at the time, and therefore didn't have the need to ask for a second bailout. And this is very important because this was something that was always denied to Greece. So although Greece asked for this, that the European Central Bank would directly intervene on the managing of Greek public debt, they always said European Central Bank cannot manage it directly. They did it with Portugal, and they did it for political reasons. They did it to make sure that the right wing would win the elections again, because since Portugal did not have to ask for a second bailout, the right wing could capitalize on the idea that, yes, we did a lot of sacrifices the last 4 years. The economy is still unstable, but we were able to not ask for a second bailout. So we were the ones who took us out of this situation. And this was a very important message or idea during the elections. I think the second reason was the fact that the Socialist Party did a very bad campaign. And they did a very bad campaign, not only for like media communication problems that also happened, but for the reason that it was very unclear what the differences, and there we go again, the differences between their political program and proposal were compared to the right wing. Because let's also remind everyone that the Socialist Party in Portugal signed the memorandum with the Troika as the right wing did. So there were no big differences on their economic and political program. And I think the third reason is, although the left grew a lot, and we grew from, Bloco grew from 5% to 10%, we more than doubled our votes, it's still unclear if, for example, Bloco can be a party power, so a party that can actually win elections and rule a country. And so in a way, Bloco is still a sort of like opposition party, a party that has an oppositional flair. Of course, that is not what Bloco is, but that is how it is perceived. And I think if you look at the differences between Portugal and Greece, although Syriza was the same type of power, not only the conditions were much more extreme, but very importantly, and I think this is also a key question, very importantly was that the grassroots movements and the way that the party created a link with those movements were fundamental for the shift in the votes that Syriza had. Also, and I think it's also important, and if we're comparing the two countries, at the time, PASOK entered the government with the right wing, And therefore, it completely disappears. So Syriza won a part of PASOK's constituency. And PASOK is from the same political family as the Socialist Party in Portugal. So that's what they did in October. They did not go into a government with a right wing. Because, and I guess this is also an important lesson for them, what they learned is also, if they do that, then probably what happened in Greece will happen to them. So, but we're not at the same time and moment or context. So although there are a lot of similarities, there are also a lot of differences between the two countries that provoke different, of course, effects and outcomes.
Finally, Katerina, what do you make of, speaking of Greece, what do you make of former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis's decision to and an effort to create a pan-European left movement from the bottom-up DiEM25 movement that he has tried to lead or signed on to? I mean, does this idea of having this pan-Europeanism, can it work? Can this be a kind of force that could help the left speak more directly to the concerns of ordinary Europeans?
I think that depends on how it is done. I don't believe that it is possible to build political movements today that ask for the reformation of the European Union, for a very clear reason. Because in order to be able to apply today any sort of left-wing measure, and let me also remind you that the only spaces that are left that have any sort of democratic, even if flair sometimes, but that have a democratic experience, they only exist at the level of the nation state still today in Europe. They have never existed at the level of the European level, and much less do they exist today. So the idea that we can build, or that it can, that there can be a mass movement that asks for the reformation or the refoundation of a program or of a project that was always a neoliberal one, that is already a complicated idea for me. But still, if we look at it today, because the left has done that for many years, but if we look at it today, what we're going to find is that if we want to apply the simplest measures at the level of the nation state, especially if you're coming from periphery countries, you have to confront European powers. So if you want to say we want to renegotiate our debt, which is a fundamental thing, if we want to in any way end austerity at the long term and not just like manage austerity or have it light now and then wait for what comes next, but if we actually want to revert austerity policies, we need to confront the European institutions. If we want to have a functioning social state, we need to confront European powers. If we want to have a functioning labor market, we need to say no and reject and disobey the labor laws that are coming from non-democratic, non-elected structures at the European level. So for me, the idea that we want to reform this structure seems very strange or foreign to me. So I think that right now we need pan-European or transnational structures, but this is not new, nor did Yanis Varoufakis create them. They have been happening for many years. There's a lot of very interesting experiences that have been tried out. I want to recall two, for example, the multi-state general strike that happened in 2012, or the Blockupy protests in Germany that have been happening for the last years and have been fundamental for bringing back from the bottom up, bringing actually movement activists, people that are doing politics in their own countries together in a country, in a demonstration to say no to this Europe. So I think these are the interesting experiences that we have been observing and participating in the last years. But at the same time, I think we need to do this all the time if we're talking about Europe. We always need to talk on two levels. And I think the left has been afraid for the last decades to talk about the national level and the importance of the national level as still the only remaining space of somehow democratic structuring of life and politics. And so I think we always need to navigate this at two levels. We need to understand that we need to fight for the policies that are fundamental to shift austerity, renegotiation of the debt. We need to fight for public control of the banking system. We need to fight for a functioning welfare state, for the renationalization of all the strategic sectors of the economy that have been privatized over the last years. And if we do this, because they are fundamental proposals and demands, if we do this, they are not possible within the EU. Right now, they're not.
Right.
We are constantly being threatened by that. So actually defending left-wing ideas and anti-austerity ideas means we are confronting the European institutions right now, every day. And of course, at the same time, we know that there are no national solutions to the crisis. Neither a country, for example, like Portugal, that has a completely destroyed productive sector, that, by the way, was the exchange coin for entering the European Union. So we had some sort of productive sector, even if not so modernized, that was substituted by a sector of non-tradable goods so that we could import the products that are produced at the core of the European Union. And so the European Union has always been a project of center-periphery. It is a transnational program, but that is composed by competing nation states. So if we don't understand constantly the two levels of this project, we're always going to fail.
Well, Katarina, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We're going to have some more interviews from the book that you co-edited later in the week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Katarina Príncipe is a social movement activist from Portugal. She writes for Jacobin magazine. She's the co-editor of a new anthology we've been discussing called Europe in Revolt. And her essay in that book is called The Deferred Portuguese Revolution. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Thank you.